For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Daniel, great, interesting Old Testament prophet. Tonight we're going to study chapter 2, which contains the first one of the major visions. There's five of these in Daniel. This one was given first to the Babylonian emperor Nebuchadnezzar. We read in chapter 2, verse 1, that in the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his mind was troubled, and he could not sleep. Someone pointed out last week that the second year of his reign, although we read earlier that Daniel's schooling was 3 years. So, what's the chronology here? It looks like this happened while Daniel was still a student in school. And that probably accounts for why when they called in the wise men to interpret it, Daniel was not among them, because he later became one of the wise men. And then it must have taken some time before they got around to going out and trying to execute all the wise men and wizards. By then, Daniel had graduated, and so he was considered a wise man and subject to execution. So that really explains the data pretty well. Well, the king summoned the magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and astrologers to tell him what he had dreamed when they came in and stood before the king. He said, "I have had a dream that troubles me, and I want to know what it means." Then the astrologers answered the king, in Aramaic, "O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will interpret it." The king replied to the astrologers, "This is what I've firmly decided. If you don't tell me what I dreamed was and interpret it, then I'm going to have you cut in pieces and your houses turned into piles of rubble. But if you tell me the dream and explain it, then you'll receive from me gifts, rewards, and great honor. So tell me the dream and interpret it for me." So old Neb must be a little suspicious about his wizards here, that they're just blowing smoke up his saddle. And he's devised a little authentication system that, you know, if you guys are really getting divine insight and all that kind of thing, then you should not only be able to tell me what it means, you should be able to tell me what it is. And he'll be able to know who's actually got the supernatural pipeline this way. "Well," then once more they replied, "come on, let's tell the servants of the king and we'll interpret it for him." But the king answered, "I'm certain that you're trying to gain time because you realize that this is what I firmly decided. If you don't tell me the dream, there's just one penalty for you. You've conspired to tell me misleading and wicked things, hoping the situation will change. So then, tell me the dream, and I'll know then that you can interpret it for me." Nice system. Well, the astrologers answered the king, "Hey, come on, there's not a man on earth who can do what the king asks. No king, however great and mighty, has ever asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or astrologer. What the king asks is too difficult. Who can reveal it to the king except the gods? And they don't live among men." But that kind of begs the question, right? I mean, isn't that the whole point, that they're supposed to be in contact with God or a god of some sort? This made the king so angry and furious that he ordered the execution of all the wise men of Babylon. So this becomes a real problem. Well, you know, that's the way it often is with astrologers and diviners. They give you some real general statements about this is what probably happened, and this is going to happen, and it's things that usually happen anyway, so it's just real hard to tell whether they guessed it or coincidence or whatever. So, yeah, and he can tell they're just bobbing and weaving here and making excuses. They don't have anything. And he unmasks that neatly. And, of course, takes kind of the typical ancient solution, slaughter them all. So the decree was issued to put the wise men to death. And men were sent to look for Daniel and his friends to put them to death. They, by now, are also considered wise men. But you notice they weren't there. And that becomes clear as we go on. They don't even know what they're talking about, so they completely missed this earlier interview. When Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, had gone out to put to death the wise men of Babylon, Daniel spoke to him with wisdom and tact. He asked the king's officer, "Why did the king issue such a harsh decree?" Then Arioch then explained the matter to Daniel. At this, Daniel went into the king and asked for time so that he might interpret the dream for him. Then Daniel returned to his house and explained the matter to his friends Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. He urged them to plead for mercy from God of heaven concerning this mystery so that he and his friends might not be executed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. During the night, the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision. Then Daniel praised the God of heaven and said, "Praise be to the name of God forever and ever. Wisdom and power are his. He changes times and seasons, sets up kings and deposes them. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to the discerning. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what lies in darkness, and light dwells with him. I thank and praise you, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and power. You have made known to me what we asked of you. You have made known to us the dream of the king." Then Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to execute the wise men of Babylon. He said to him, "Do not execute the wise men of Babylon. Take me to the king, and I will interpret his dream for him." Arioch took Daniel to the king at once and said, "I found a man among the exiles from Judah who can tell the king what his dream means." The king asked Daniel, also called Belshazzar, "Are you able to tell me what I saw in my dream and interpret it?" Daniel replied, "No wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery he's asked about. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. He has shown King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in the days to come. Your dream and the visions that passed through your mind as you lay on your bed are these. As you were lying there, O king, your mind turned to things to come, and the revealer of mysteries showed you what's going to happen. As for me, this mystery has been revealed to me not because I have greater wisdom than other living men, but so that you, O king, may know the interpretation and that you may understand what went through your mind." So he completely gives credit to God. And then he recounts the dream. "You looked, O king, and there before you stood a large statue, an enormous, dazzling statue, awesome in appearance. The head of the statue was made of pure gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs made of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of baked clay. While you were watching, a rock was cut out, but not by human hands. It struck the statue at its feet of iron and clay and smashed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were broken into pieces at the same time and became like chaff on a threshing floor in the summer. The wind swept them away without leaving a trace. But the rock that struck the statue became a huge mountain and filled the whole earth. This was the dream. And now, we'll interpret it to the king. You, O king, are the king of kings. The God of heaven has given you dominion and power and might and glory. In your hands he has placed mankind and the beasts of the field and the birds of the air. Wherever they live, he has made you ruler over them all. You are the head of gold. After you, another kingdom will arise, inferior to yours. And next, a third kingdom, one of bronze, will rule over the whole earth. Finally, there will be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, for iron breaks and smashes everything. And as iron breaks things to pieces, so it will crush and break all the others. Just as you saw that the feet and the toes were partly of baked clay, partly of iron, so this will be a divided kingdom. And yet it will have some of the strength of the iron in it, even as you saw the iron mixed with the clay. As the toes were partly iron and partly clay, so this kingdom will be partly strong and partly brittle. And just as you saw the iron mixed with baked clay, so the people will be a mixture and will not remain united any more than iron mixes with clay. In the time of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it be left to another people. It will crush all those kingdoms and bring them to an end, but it itself will endure forever. This is the meaning of the vision of the rock cut out of the mountain, but not by human hands, a rock that broke the iron, bronze, clay, and silver and the gold to pieces. The great God has shown the king what will take place in the future. The dream is true, and the interpretation is trustworthy. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell prostrate before Daniel and paid him honor and ordered that an offering and incense be presented to him. Very unusual for ancient monarchs to do something like this, but you know, they believed in the supernatural, and he knew that he had just encountered something completely supernatural, because that dream was a dead ringer for what he had had in his sleep. The king said to Daniel, "Surely your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you were able to reveal this mystery." And so we have then the first vision in the book of Daniel. We want to go back now and just look at this carefully and think about, what does this represent? It's supposed to be representing a future succession of kingdoms. The first part, he says, "You looked, O king, and there before you stood a large statue, an enormous, dazzling statue, awesome in appearance." Okay, I'm guessing, you know, what it looked like. The head of the statue, made out of gold, chest and silver, and a chest and the arms made of silver, belly and thighs made of bronze, legs made of iron, and the feet partly of iron and partly of baked clay. So there's the basic schematic that we have here. Each successive type of metal and part of the body represents another empire. These are the theme we talked about last week of human empire and dominion over other humans. And the first one he interprets for us in verse 37 and 38. He says, "You are the head of gold." So we know the first part, the head, is Nebuchadnezzar, is the Neo-Babylonian Empire, the one that they're living in at the time. He says, "After you then, another will come, and that must be the Media-Persian Empire." The reason we can make this identification, for one thing, has to do with correlation. And correlation is going to become a pretty important thing in reading the book of Daniel. The way it's set up with these five visions is that each one relates to the other. So what we develop is like a matrix that guides the interpreter. You have to basically compare these visions with each other. They cover the same series of events, but each one is successively more detailed and focused, and they begin to focus specifically on one or another of the aspects or parts in this sequence. And so it's really an interesting feature that you don't find in a lot of so-called prophetic literature. Like if you've ever read Nostradamus, for instance, a lot of people think that's prophetic. I don't think so. But one thing's for sure, you know, basically the interpreter is free to assign any meaning they want to, because there's no way to tell what the relatively meaningless sequence of words means. So you just say, "Well, I think it means this," and there's no way to discuss it. It's like whatever you want it to mean. Now, in biblical prophecy, it's different than that. And in the Bible, we have not only this entire book, but really all of the books of the Bible, we believe, inspired by God. And so they can be compared, and there is a unified message across the books of the Bible. And by correlating these sources, then, it prevents us from making mistakes and jumping off into our own opinion, and we have to stick more with what was originally intended. That's the way it's set up in the one after next, in chapter 8. He gives this same sequence of empires. In that vision, we read in verse 20, though, the one that corresponds with the one that replaces the first kingdom, the Babylonian Empire. in that one, it's a series of animals that come through. And the two-horned ram that you saw represents the kings of Media and Persia. That positively identifies exactly who the empire is that replaced the Neo-Babylonian Empire. And of course, historically, we know that the Persians did conquer Babylon, did replace them, and this was an event that happens later in Daniel's own lifetime, in 539 BC. Next, we have the belly and the thighs of bronze. We would identify this with the Grecian Empire, introduced under the great conqueror Alexander the Great. The reasons that we would do so, in the first place, correlation. Again, going to that same passage, the parallel vision in chapter 8:21, it names who this is. The next animal after the two-horned ram is a shaggy goat. And it says the shaggy goat is the king of Greece. And the large horn, that he's growing one horn out between his eyes. It was a pretty weird-looking shaggy goat. But the horn, which was seen as a seat of power of an animal, because they, you know, would mess you up with their horn, is the first king, i.e. Alexander. And then it goes on, the horn is broken off early, it says, and four other horns come up, and it talks about how the Grecian Empire was broken up into four pieces. All of that happened, and we'll cover that in detail when we get there, but yeah, so this is definitely the Grecian Empire. And in fact, these identifications are so obvious, they're not disputed, even by scholars that don't believe the Bible or in the supernatural. Naturalistic scholars would agree that this is what it predicts. Now, you can imagine, if you're a naturalistic scholar, you don't believe in God, you don't believe in the supernatural, how could Daniel, writing in, you know, 590s, let's say, or 600 BC, know that the Persians were going to take over the Babylonians? That didn't look very likely at that time. Know that they would be taken over by the Greeks, a power that was inconsequential in the Middle East. They had never been in the Middle East before. That was totally unanticipated. Well, of course, from their perspective, since this author writes about the Persians and the Greeks, he obviously knows about them. Therefore, we date the book after that time. That's how you solve that problem. Well, we'll talk about the dating of Daniel. And of course, we know that Greece conquered Persia historically, so there's little choice, really, about who this is referring to. The next one are the legs of iron. And this would have to represent the Roman Empire, the next great empire that arose historically in this part of the world. Each of these empires are empires that have to do with the nation of Israel in some direct way. This has to be Rome in the first place because it's represented by iron, and he goes on at some length about how iron is stronger than any other metal. That was the strongest metal they knew, and it would break and shatter all things. And so the awesome power of this empire is contrasted with the others, and it's obviously much greater. And that is a good description, really, of the Roman Empire. Larger, more powerful, sustained longer, far more successful than any of them at dominating and controlling the lives of millions of its citizens and vassals. So, yeah, I mean, it's a dead ringer. Then, too, we can correlate this with chapter 7 and chapter 8, both of which have the same sequence, and they're, both of those actually focus extensively on the fourth kingdom in this sequence. So it's too long to go through right now, but we'll go through it next week and the week after, all right? So I hope if you get involved in studying Daniel here, you can't get it just by studying one chapter, okay? You have to see the sequence, and you have to see how they work together. That's really where the power of this book lies. You need to plan, if you're interested in this, you need to plan on coming tonight and at least three more weeks if you really want to have your mind blown. And of course, historically, we know that these Grecian powers, which had now broken up into four separate empires, were all swept away by Rome. And so we have an identification now for the legs, for the thighs and belly, for the chest, and for the head. This leaves us with the feet. Feet are kind of strange. Up until now, each section of the body has been a new metal. But in the case of the feet, it's still iron, but it's different because now there's kind of a mixture of iron and clay. It's some sort of an amalgam or a swirl. So basically, the feet seem like they're the same as the legs, but they're also different. They're certainly related, must be related in some way to the legs. But on the other hand, there's a depth, you know, they're discussed as a separate part of the body, and their composition is different. Iron and clay does not equal iron. So they're different. We'll find, I'm going to argue to you, that these refer to two different but related empires. And this actually is common in prophetic literature in the Old Testament to have what we call double reference or typology, which is where you have two similar related things discussed in the same place together. And we might as well get into this because it's going to come up two or three times in the book of Daniel. Okay, let's think about what does this mean, this double reference business. All right, your assumptions basically are, in the first place, the prophet receives his vision as an intuition or sometimes as a visual picture. With some of Daniel's, he keeps saying, then I saw this, then I saw that, and so forth. It almost sounds like he's watching a movie. And so these may be actual visual visions. Sometimes they're dreams. At other times, they're intuitions. But in prophecy, it's not, you know, laid out schematically, but it comes as more of an impression and a vision. All the information then that's given in this visual or intuitive vision is accurate, but it's not exhaustive. Some parts are left out. And as a result, it has sort of a telescoping effect. These similar events are recounted without mentioning the fact that they're separated by a lengthy period of time. Double reference, however, you can't just say, well, I think there's double reference here. The burden is on the interpreter. If you think that a passage involves double reference, you have to show from the passage itself that that's warranted. It's certainly nothing as a principle of interpretation, a principle of hermeneutics. You just can't go in and start assigning meanings like this as you see fit. We're trying to find out what the text actually says. And that's why, if there is double reference, the text is going to clearly indicate that. As we'll see, we have three or four instances of this in the book of Daniel. And in each case, there's a clear textual case for what we're saying. So it's sort of like if we have the guy on the left here, the prophet, looking forward. He sees a vision, a dude. And then he also sees another dude. And they're similar. They're somehow linked. We use the word typology because in Greek they use the term tupos. We get the word type, or we say, you know, this is typical of that. That comes from the Greek language where the tupos was the die and the antitupos was the cast. Or maybe it's the other way around. I forget which is which. But, you know, if you had a guy's face on a cast and then you have a die that presses the metal into the cast, the picture on the die is just like the picture on the cast, right? Except it's reversed. So it's like they're not the same, but they are the same. And that's the picture then that the Greeks used for this notion of typology. You have a lot of types in the Bible. It's a form of symbolism that's rigidly restricted because you have to have a bona fide and clear similarity and connection between the two. So in this illustration, the first little dude would be the type, and the other dude would be the antitupos, the antitype. Now, the thing is, the prophet will see this, and he sees both of them sort of as a single intuition or picture. What he doesn't see is the part in between them. So it's kind of like when you're mountain climbing and you think, oh, nice, I see the summit right ahead, and you get up there, and lo and behold, between what you thought was the summit and the real summit, there's a huge valley you got to go down. That happens all the time. And that sort of future vision forward is often distorted in that way. Now, here's an interesting little point. These prophetic gaps happen in a number of passages in the Bible. And the most common period of time that is skipped over is the time between the first and second comings of Messiah. Now, that's a fascinating point. Think about Jesus in Luke chapter 4, the first time he got up to preach. He got out the book of Isaiah, and he read, how I've come to proclaim liberty to the captives and healing to the sick and so forth, to loose the prisoners. And he stops at a certain point to proclaim the favorable year of our Lord. And he stops reading, rolls up the scroll, puts it away, and he says, "Today, this prophecy of Isaiah has been fulfilled in your hearing." Well, it's pretty weird if you go back and look at Isaiah 61, the passage he was quoting, because it keeps going. The very next line is, "In the favorable year of our Lord, comma, and the day of vengeance of our God." And it goes on to proclaim how Messiah, King Messiah, will take over and impose peace on the earth, and Israel will have all of its dreams realized, and there'll never be any problems again. He didn't read that part. He only read up to that comma and stopped, put it away, and he says, "Today this has been fulfilled in your hearing." Well, as Christians, of course, we believe that the rest of that prophecy is still going to be fulfilled, but not yet. It won't happen until the second coming of Christ. The strange thing is that the Jews did not have, one thing is never revealed in the Old Testament, and that is that there are two comings of the Messiah. They saw these as one and the same. And you can see why, if there's a prophetic gap that's not mentioned there, why wouldn't you think that both things happen at the same time? That's the way it's presented. And this apparently was purposefully done by God, not revealing that there's a big gap of time and two separate comings of the Messiah for purposes that are not our subject tonight. So that's that one we're studying. It would take most of the evening to get into this very fascinating subject. This is what's referred to as the mystery hidden for ages past in the New Testament, that there are two comings of the Messiah, the first as the suffering servant, the second as the reigning king. And in most of our Old Testament prophetic gaps in time, the part that's missing is the part from the first coming of Christ to the second, so that both comings look like they're one and the same. Well, double reference or typology. There's other types of typology, and there's even other types of double reference. We'll see a different type of double reference, and I'll diagram that when we get. We don't want to get too complicated here. I'm going to argue to you that in this case, with the legs and the feet, which refer to two different but related empires, what we have here is a prophetic gap. We're looking at one of these prophetic gaps right here. And I'm going to give you five reasons why I think that's true. Remember, the burden of evidence is on the interpreter who says there's a prophetic gap or a double reference here. In the first place, the syntax, as we go down the statue, each part that's mentioned separately, like the belly and the thighs are mentioned together. But it mentions, it goes from section to section, and in this case it goes from the legs and discusses them, and then it talks about the feet separate from the legs. And so the syntax makes it sound like this is not the same empire. Also, the composition of the feet is different than the composition of the legs. The legs are iron, the feet are iron and clay. So there's good reason to think from this text itself that these are referring to two different things. Now, another point, and particularly this would be relevant if you're a Bible-believing reader. If you think the Bible is significant, then you're inclined to believe that these predictions mean something. For Christian readers, certainly we would have to note that God lands this stone, not cut by human hands, on the feet, and the statue explodes and is blown away, and then that becomes a mountain that fills the whole earth, and that's the kingdom of God. And that happens during the reign of the feet. He says it's during the reign of those kings, the feet, that this stone lands, an event which has still not happened even in our own day. This event still has not happened yet. And so that would make you think that the feet part might still lie in the future, and there's a prophetic gap here. Maybe the feet, maybe it's like the other prophetic gaps, and the feet have something to do with the second coming of Christ. Fourth point is that three different times he refers and calls attention to the ten toes. And he uses the expression in the time of those kings. Whereas in the Roman Empire was not a multiple group of kings. There was only one emperor at any time. Even if you tried to cut out 10 significant emperors, some interpreters have tried to do this, it doesn't work. There's many more than that. And besides, it says that these 10 kings are reigning together. It's the plain reading is that all 10 kings are present when the rock hits. So we're looking for something that has 10 rulers at the same time, a coalition. And that doesn't fit the Roman period. Fifth, when we correlate this with other passages, correlation again, we find that this same power, a power related to the Roman Empire, but different, it comes later in history, and it has at its center these 10 national entities brought together. In chapter 7, 23 and 4, describing the fourth beast, he says, will be a kingdom on the earth which will be different from all other kingdoms and will devour the whole earth, tread it down, and crush it. And so there's your Roman Empire again with that incredible power that they wielded, greater by far than the Persians, greater by far than the Greeks or the Babylonians. 1,400-year-long empire was the Roman Empire. But then he says, out of this kingdom, 10 kings will arise. It's not that it is this kingdom, but rather out of it. And so there is part of the Roman Empire that's extracted into these 10 other kingdoms. And as the narrative goes on, this becomes the power, a world power, present at the end of history as we know it. It comes up in other passages as well. In particular, Revelations has the same beast. And in those visions, it's a series of beasts again. Well, we're going to read all of these, by the way, and study them as we move on through Daniel. There it's a beast with 10 horns, and it says each horn has a crown on it because it's a separate kingdom. So there are 10 kingdoms, and that's the beast. This is the greatest power on earth at the time of the book of Revelations. So still in the New Testament period, already under Roman rule, this kingdom is considered something out in the future. And so you have five reasons for thinking that we're looking at a prophetic gap here. Four of these empires have already come and gone. The fifth one, which is related to the fourth somehow, has not yet appeared, even in our own day. So who then are these feet? Basically, they're extracted from the Roman people and the Roman culture. When we see the correlation in chapter 9 of Daniel, for instance, he's clear that it's the people of the prince who is to come, that are the Romans. It's the people of the Roman Empire. That's what matters. So it's not the geographical identification, but rather the people and culture of Rome that form this future power, which would basically be Europe. It's true, Rome had holdings in Turkey, the Middle East, and right around to North Africa. But because of the Muslim incursions in the 600s, those areas have long since departed from any similarity to Roman culture, Roman law, Roman language, Roman traditions. It's only really in Europe that those have continued. you know, still today, European culture and language, we talk about the Romance languages. Well, that means that they're related to Latin, to Rome. And, you know, our concepts of government and law derive from Rome. It's really Rome that has had more influence on our art, even our musical scales and everything else all go back to Rome and beyond Rome, even to Greece. But Greece and Rome have had the main influence. That's really where Western culture comes from. So what we're reading then is that one day, the Bible says there will be a coalition of 10 national powers based on European culture and people. It's explained in this passage to be in some ways strong like Rome was strong. It's got great strength and power, but it doesn't have the kind of cohesion and unity that Rome had. And he stresses that just like iron won't mix with clay, this empire, it's like it's got all this power, but its weakness is the disunity there, the inability to coalesce, to come together. Just, he says, as iron won't mix with clay. And so there's sort of a picture here of a power that is superior to other powers, just like Rome was, but which has disunity always just lingering under the surface. Here's the language. Just as you saw, the feet and toes were partly baked of baked clay and partly of iron, so this will be a divided kingdom. And yet it will have some of the strength of iron in it, as you saw the iron mixed with the clay, and as the toes were partly iron and partly clay, so this kingdom will be partly strong and partly brittle. So to summarize our findings, this passage is really predicting that the people of the ancient Roman Empire one day are going to revive that power. The Roman Empire is coming back in an altered form. It's not going to be the same, but it's basically going to be that people and culture, and it's going to become a world empire once again. It's got to be mainly based in Europe or maybe European colonies where they have followed, where they're made up of the people of Europe and where they follow the cultural traditions based on Rome. This new version is going to be strong like the old one was, but not as cohesive as the old one was. And there'll be a tendency to fragment there. And it's a very important empire because it comes up here in Daniel 2 and multiple other times in Daniel and Revelations keep talking about this empire. This empire is going to be so powerful that they will gain hegemony over the whole earth, we read at the end of history as we know it. Hegemony, ascendancy, or basically control through intimidation. They basically, it says that every nation, tribe, tongue, and people will follow after this empire. Everyone in the world, it says, and I'm kind of quoting Revelation here, but don't worry because we're going to read all this stuff in detail as we get there. It says, all the people in the world are like, who can wage war with this power? They're too awesome. And so they're intimidated and they follow after. They basically do whatever they're told because they don't want to mess with them. They're that powerful. And so we have sort of a remarkable and, in a way, strange prediction before us. I'm going to wonder, how absurd is this proposition, this prediction, that a power like that is on the way? Europe unified into one political unity? You know, the first time I heard this taught was in 1967. I was not a Christian. I was a non-believer at the time. But my older brother was a believer, and he talked me into going to this lecture and agreed that we could go out and party afterward. But he wanted to hear this guy lecture, and so I was like, all right, whatever. And so we went to, and he was teaching Daniel, and he went over this passage. It was the first time I'd ever heard anything like this. And he made the claim, he said, Europe is going to become one nation. And he thought, you know, not too long from now.
1967. Well, most of us, you know, I'm pretty old. A lot of us can't remember what it was like in 67. But that was about the stupidest idea I'd ever heard. There was no hint of unity of that sort in Europe at that time. They had a common market since 48, but that meant almost nothing. It meant almost nothing at the time. It just meant they talked to each other. I talked to my brother afterwards. I says, "Do you actually believe that that's going to happen?" And he's like, "Yeah, I do." I scoffed at him. I scoffed at my brother. I was just like, "Man, it's like, I don't know what's wrong with you. You believe anything. Think about it. You know, world wars. These nations and tribes have been warring for millennia up there. They'll never give up their individual autonomy. They're never going to form a single..." This speaker called it a United States of Europe. I'm like, "Dude, that's not going to happen. Even if it did, would such an entity be the most powerful nation on earth? Come on." Everyone knows it's the U.S. Come on. Europe, the sick man, the weakling countries of Europe, with all of their, at that time, their economic woes were overwhelming. They were mired in socialism and just losing it. Well, a lot's changed since those days. 30-some years since then. One by one, each decade, you just see the tumblers falling into place. In the early 70s, they changed it from what they called the common market to the European community, and or the ECC, and more union began to be formed. Probably the most significant treaty that's been signed recently is the Maastricht Treaty on European Union, signed by the countries in Europe in 1992. In this treaty, it says in Article B, the Union shall set itself to the following objectives: to promote economic and social progress through the creation of an area without internal frontiers, through the establishment of economic and monetary union, ultimately including a single currency. Well, of course, each of these have already been accomplished now. In the late 90s, the borders of Europe, which you used to, if you've ever traveled in Europe, it used to be, you know, if you were crossing from France into Germany or Italy, it was an hour sitting in line waiting to go through customs, show your passport, maybe have them search your car, and then you could go through. Major hassle. Not anymore. If you've been in Europe lately, driving from France into Germany is just a sign by the side. It's like driving from Ohio into Indiana. Nobody asks anything. And so it's pretty remarkable. It's really pretty remarkable. When last time I was, not the last time, but the time before, I was there kind of the week that they opened the borders. And it was all over the TV. Everyone was talking about it. And then we, you know, went across a couple of these borders, and there was the old border guard house, and the guys just sitting there, you know. I was like, "This is sweet." And it's predicted in the Bible that this union is going to happen, and much more besides. The Europeans intend to forge this into like a United States. It goes on to the goal. Of Europe is to assert its identity on the international scene, in particular through the implementation of a common foreign and security policy, including the eventual framing of a common defense policy, which might in time lead to a common defense. So they want to have the same international policy, the same defense policy, and ultimately the same defense, i.e., there'll be, you know, the Army of Europe, the Navy of Europe, where they actually have the same armed forces and share them. That's their intent. Well, you know, the Europeans just voted down a constitution for Europe last year. So that's a major setback. But it's been that way the whole time. You know, two or three steps forward, a couple of steps back. And then they'll go forward. This development has been seeming to me to be painstakingly slow, but always inexorable. They want it in Europe. The majority of Europeans want this. They want union. They know that they would be competitive with the U.S. if they were a United States like we are. And it used to be just an awful burden on business to have to cross these borders with goods and stuff, pay tariffs, change your currency constantly. Now all of Europe under one currency, the euro. See, and we're used to these things. But how odd it was to read these predictions back 30-some years ago when none of this was in place and have it projected and then see it gradually coming to pass before our eyes.
This is from the EU's website called the EU in Brief. European integration began when founding members set about creating a single market in which goods, services, people, and capital would move as freely as within one country. The single market came into being in January 1993 after the signing of the Maastricht Treaty. Very significant signpost in the history of Europe. You know, our news hardly ever carries any of this. I can't believe we're getting national news stories on a sick dog or this kind of thing, and entire sweeping events in the world are just never even mentioned in our news because we're not interested in them. Agenda 2000, a paper they all agreed on and wrote, says the European Union has a global role to play. It must bolster its ability to take political decisions and ensure that all its various activities form a cohesive whole. The Union requests that the Western European Union, WEU, which is an integral part of the development of the Union, to elaborate and implement decisions and actions of the Union which have defense implications. The WEU is a group of the original and most powerful military nations in the EU that go back to a different treaty, but the EU today considers the WEU to be, you know, part and parcel of it, the difference being that they're really the military powers. This is reading again from the Treaty on European Union, the Maastricht Treaty, Article J4, 1 and 2. Here's a slide from the NATO website where they identify these countries. The EU has, you know, partner nations, observer nations, inner nations, associate nations. It's kind of elaborate. It's 25 nations in all involved. The Western EU are these: Belgium, France, Germany, Greece, Italy, Luxembourg, Netherlands, Portugal, Spain, and the UK, which is 10 nations. Now, I'm not saying there's your 10 nations, okay? Please don't quote me as saying that. I just thought it was interesting. I'm not saying that. I don't know who the 10 nations are. But I do know that this group, the whole group of them, are striving for unity, and that is the intent. Of course, there are holdouts in various countries that are kind of stick in the mud and foot draggers, and they don't want to give up their individual autonomy. But the rewards are potentially so great. Most people in Europe really want this. So when we think of these clauses from the treaty, that they're going to get a common foreign and security policy, that the Western Union is going to implement decisions and actions of the Union which have defense implications. In other words, they're going to field the armies, the Air Force, and so forth. When we think of the descriptions of goods and services flowing back and forth in Europe like across borders as if it was within a single country, when we think of all of Europe using the same currency, under the same rules of commerce and banking, how much difference is there between this and a single national entity? Definitely that's their goal. Thing is, one of the problems with the EU has been all along, and is still right there today, disunity. It's like they'll give up a little bit of their sovereignty, but they want to hold some back too. And they don't want other, you know, they don't want Germans and French people telling us what to do. And so there's this very creaky forward movement in this power, and it's really, for all the world, exactly like the iron mixed with clay. It's like there's so much potential, but there's so much disunity there, and this tendency to say, well, we'll just leave the EU if you do that. Still, this question, is this notion of the reunification of Europe predicted in the Bible, is that absurd?
No way. I think it's happening right here historically in front of us.
What about this notion that this union is going to become the most powerful nation on earth?
Europe? Please. They're coming, kind of seem like they're becoming weaker by the day over there.
Definitely USA. Everyone knows that. This is ridiculous.
Well, let's look at a few things. Yeah, that is true if you consider the U.S. compared to individual nations within Europe. But not if you consider Europe as a union. For instance, economic power, out of which flows seemingly all things these days, U.S. versus EU, well, they're putting out more than we are. Significantly more. 1.2 and a half trillion compared to our barely over 1 trillion. What about population? Oh yeah, they're much larger than we are. Much larger. U.S. is getting up toward, we're just at almost 300 million today. But the EU stands at over 4.5 million. So they're a very large country. Gross domestic product, about the same. We import more than they do. It's not such a great news. We export less than they do, and we import more than they do. That's why we've gone from being the biggest creditor nation to the biggest debtor nation in the world over the past few decades. I don't know how great that is. Investment in each other. There is a huge, immense economic bond tying together the U.S. and the EU. Better part of $1 trillion in investment going each direction. So it's just like woven together economically. So many of these countries. Compare that, a lot of people, remember when people were worried that Japan was buying the U.S.? You know, they bought the World Trade Center, they buying all these famous pieces of real estate, and people were like, oh man, we're selling our country to the Japanese. Not really. Actually, Japan's investment here is negligible compared to the investment by the EU. Hardly a tenth. Writing all the way back in 1990, so it's 15 years old now. Silva and Shogren wrote about European unification. They said, with so much attention directed to Japan, the fact that a combined Europe would account for 20% of the world's exports against 15% for the United States and Japan's 9% has been overlooked. Now, in view of the plan for unification, Europe's previously disjointed consumers will combine to form a 340, you can read 460 million person trading consumption machine that will fire up both offensively and defensively to achieve international consumption goals of a combined Europe, outnumbering the populations of the United States and of Japan. They comment that in 1988, Schmick Medley polled Americans to find out which countries they thought invested most in American companies. 73% of those polled assumed that Japan accounted for the majority investment. 10% cited oil-rich Arab countries. Well, only 3% knew that Europe had taken the lead. The EC accounts for almost 2.9 million American workers. This is, again, this is writing in 1990, so you can probably at least double, or I don't know what the number is right now. Much larger than that, which is double the number of U.S. workers employed by the rest of the world combined. You see, the U.S. and Europe are deeply linked and tied together on economic grounds. You have such close ties and linkage, not to mention the various treaties we hold with them, and even though the U.S. and Europe aren't getting along too well at the moment under the Bush presidency. Historically, we do agree with Europe on most things, and we tend to be on their side of the fence most of the time. There's every reason to think that that's going to continue. That's what they say. That's what our government says as well. Us and Europe, NATO, so on, we're together. But it's very possible, I think, to imagine that the U.S., when we think of this great power of the last days, could also include the U.S. as part of this. The U.S. is also made up of the people and culture of Rome. Our governmental and social institutions have Roman derivation through Europe. And most of the people here came from Europe. Those are the institutions that the country's based on. Yeah, we're getting more and more non-European immigrants, but the European character of American culture is unmistakable. And so I think it's very possible, because, you know, one of the things that strikes me is the way it talks about in Revelation how all the nations in the world, all the peoples and tongues look at this awesome power and says, who wants to make war with them? They're viewed as this incredible military power that's just too awesome to be messed with. And that's one of the things that makes me think the U.S. could end up as part of this. So the answer to our question, could such a resurrected Rome become the most powerful nation on earth? Sure could. If those nations were unified today, they would easily dwarf the power of any other nation on earth. I know when this proposition was first put, I was sitting there thinking, okay, first of all, the U.S. is the most powerful, and if we weren't, the next would certainly be the Soviet Union. So things can change pretty quick, huh? Let's read the last part of the vision. He says, you continued looking until a stone was cut without hands, and it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and crushed them. Then the iron, clay, bronze, silver, and gold were crushed all at the same time, became like chaff from the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away so there wasn't a trace left. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. And so really the point of the vision is that this is God's rejoinder to human empire and sovereignty and autonomy. Man can build all of his little empires and everything else, and God's going to hurdle a stone cut not with human hands. Humans have nothing to do with it. God himself cuts the stone, and that will blow all of these away, and his stone will turn into a mountain that fills the earth. He's going to blow away human empire, and he's going to set up his kingdom. Interestingly, this event happens, according to Daniel, during the tenure of this last 10-nation confederation. Now that's interesting. So, to summarize, we've seen that this passage predicts the course of human history and the Western world. When you correlate what we have in chapter 2 with the other chapters, and I hope you'll show up for this, the interpretation becomes pretty unmistakable. I mean, you can look at it for yourself. We're going to go right through and you can make your own decision, but I think you'll agree. And it terminates with the kingdom of God, where God retakes the world and imposes peace on the world, finally under his leadership. An event which might be closer than we think. You know, today we have to look out and wonder, is it just like human history is just going to go on indefinitely? Is it just like, you know, these things always happen, there's no big deal? Not according to the Bible. The Bible says human history had a beginning when God created us, and it's got an end. One of the reasons that Jesus says that human history has to come to an end is that there was a danger that humans would destroy all life on earth. If God didn't intervene at that very moment, all life on earth would have been destroyed. This whole project of setting up human culture, living without God leading us, is a disaster. And it only goes into deeper disaster the more technological and advanced we get. Both the Old Testament and the New are adamant that yes, God is kind of hands off with the world right now and lets people do their thing. And that's why we have such a mess on earth. But it's not going to be that way forever. The day is coming when God is going to take control again. And it's going to be like, all right, you tried it your way, now we're going to do it my way. And apparently, he's going to wait until the last minute to do that. Thing is, today, I'll show you some of this as we go on in this study in the next few weeks. we have a strange situation where multiple lines of evidence are converging during our period of history. These are lines of evidence that have never existed before. Think of the unification of Europe. Charlemagne tried to do it. Napoleon tried to do it. Hitler tried to do it. None of them can make that work. And now it's just doing it all by itself. Nobody's conquering them. It's weird. This has never happened before. And we're going to go through at least a dozen different features of this whole scenario that Daniel and the book of Revelation draw that have never been true until recent and present history. Never. And when you see all these lines of unique events converging around our own period of history, I think there's pretty good reason to think we could be closer to this event than we think. I'm going to draw the line there for tonight. Next week, we'll go to chapter 7. I think 3, 4, and 5 are interesting chapters. And what we might do is finish the visions of Daniel and then maybe come back and teach those at the end. But I don't want to break our concentration because it's the correlation of these visions that makes them so impressive. So I want to just do one right after the other, okay? And this next one in 7 especially focuses on that last part, the fifth section of tonight's statue, and gives us a lot more information about it. All right, I see some questions right over here.
What do you think about the large, in view of the EU, the large Islamic population in France and Germany and Britain? They do not seem to absorb into the culture. They remain isolated. How does that fit in?
World tension, really, between the West and Islam is rising. And I think it might be one of the features that could propel Western nations into a closer association. International terrorism has demonstrated its ability to just cause even huge economies to grind to an instant halt in recent years. And there's no end in sight. It's just getting worse, if anything. And so this is when rich people don't get to make their money or lose their money, they get pretty upset about that. And I think we're going to see possibly some sort of a reaction that could be pretty menacing in its own right to Muslim extremism. And I don't know how the immigrants in Europe fit into that picture, but I know that a lot of Europeans are growing increasingly intolerant toward Islam. And it could be one of the forces at work here. Okay?
You may be planning on talking about this in the upcoming weeks, and if so, I don't want you to ruin it, but you had said that you were going to explain why it couldn't have just been written why Daniel couldn't have been written after the events, and then but written as it was going to be predictive prophecy, but it was actually written after the events actually took place.
Well, let me just give you a couple of tidbits right now, okay? There's a problem with just saying, oh, well, he knows about this, so it must have been written after that. He knows about this, must have been written after that. The problem is we've got some pretty ancient scraps from Daniel, and Daniel is in the Septuagint. Now, the Septuagint is the Greek version of the Old Testament translated by the Jews before the time of Christ, completed around 180 to 150 B.C. And Daniel is part of the Old Testament in that translation. So you really can't move it any further than that. The latest that anyone could move the date of Daniel, what liberal scholars, and they squeeze every year that they can get, would be in the 170 range BC. So already at that point, how was he able to predict that Rome would take over the Middle East? Rome was still just an Eastern Mediterranean power at that time. You know, that was back when the Punic Wars were going on. So, actually, there is no valid case for parsing Daniel down to a late date. Then, too, if we accept liberal scholarship's claim that Daniel must be from that late date, we would have to believe that while the ink was still wet, that the Jewish people read this book and decided and accepted it as scripture and as a valid forgery because they believed it was by the author Daniel in 600 to 535 B.C., and that they believed all of that within just a couple of years? It really strains the credulity. Strains the credulity powerfully. But there are many reasons for believing that Daniel actually was written at the time it states it was. And I will supply you guys with an article you can read on that if you want that I thought was pretty persuasive. Okay.
Dennis, does it have to be a literal 10 nations, this 10 number? Could this be symbolic? How do we know to interpret numbers as concrete or symbolic in the Bible?
Well, in general, if you use historical grammatical hermeneutics, which is a type of hermeneutical or interpretation where you just basically read the text and you try not to, you know, impose meaning on it, but you try to lead the meaning out from the text, it's called exegesis, not eisegesis, where you lead your meaning in. There may be symbolism in a text, but the burden is on the reader to show why you think that's symbolism and why it wouldn't just be literally what it says it is. One of the key points here is when the fulfillments come up having to do with events already passed in history, they're quite literal. So why would it not be that way for the ones yet in the future? And how do we justify the inconsistency there? I tend to believe that there are 10 nations. Sure, there could be others. There are others involved. It says all nations eventually are involved in this power, but at the center are 10 nations. Okay? I'll get him, and we'll give one, just to be fair, to this side of the room over here. I'm going all to one side. Okay, about one more over here, and just to be fair.
I've read Walvoord's Daniel commentary, and I came away not convinced that prophecies in Daniel actually lead to a European domination in that fifth empire. And from chapter 2 here, I don't see why we're connecting it to Rome, except that the material is iron between the legs and the feet. Is there more to it in chapter 2, or is there more in the rest of the Bible?
Well, I think iron is a pretty good case for connecting, because all the others are different metals. This is the only one that shares the same metal. And then you saw the language in chapter 8, where it says, out of this kingdom will rise 10 kings. So, and that was referring to Rome when it said that. So it was out of Rome will arise the 10 kings. So I think the language is, it's hard for me to see it any other way. I think it's plainly stated. We have a couple of minutes to pray together. Why don't we do that? Lord, you know, all of these prophetic visions all center around the same thing, which is your awesome plan for human history and how you are working toward your ends. And that includes an ability for us to come into a personal knowledge and relationship with you. And that is probably the most awesome part, God, is just the grace and the love that you manifest for lost people, that you're going to make it possible through Christ for us to get back into relationship with you. And so, God, we realize this study at the bottom line is not an intellectual curiosity as much as it really is a confirmation of a life-changing truth that we can know you in a personal way. And I would pray, God, that many people would come out here to just honestly investigate this, explorers, Lord, who would just look into this, and perhaps they may find a way to draw close to you in relationship through Christ.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.